From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It's Thursday, April the 16th, 2020, and we've got a good show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be talking first off about food safety with someone from the University of Vermont Extension. A lot of concern these days about am I going to catch coronavirus merely by bringing groceries into my home. We'll be finding out some about that. And later on in the second hour of the program, a very special guest. We're going to be speaking with Bill McKibben, of course, the well-known writer and environmental activist, very focused on climate change for pretty much throughout most of his career, it seems. And he has some interesting things to say, I think, about the lessons being learned from the coronavirus crisis, and maybe about heating warnings a little earlier than there seems to be a tendency not to heed initial warnings on when crises are brewing. And boy, he's been saying that about a certain other topic known as climate change for quite a while. So we'll be speaking with Mr. McKibben in the second hour of the program today. We always welcome calls from our listeners, and I want to get right into it, this topic of food safety, right off the top of the show this morning. My guest is, I hope I'm going to pronounce this right, Omar Oyarzabal. And, sir, I welcome you to the program. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so you're with UVM Extension, and do I describe it right? You are a food safety specialist with that organization.
That's right. My background is originally I have a veterinarian degree, a degree in veterinary medicine from my home country in Argentina, and then I came to the States and I did some graduate studies in the area of food safety. At that time, many years ago, it was basically using some DNA techniques to identify some pathogens in food.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things we, of course, have been talking about and hearing about a lot lately in connection with food safety is this whole business of grocery shopping has become awfully fraught in a variety of different ways. Are we going to find the things we need when we get to the store, leaving aside toilet paper? But there's some concern now, of course, about meat and other staples of the American diet. But then there, I've seen, online videos. There was one circulating on Facebook a week or two ago with a person who identified himself as a doctor and was saying you need to segregate your food as you bring it into the house and figure out different ways of disinfecting it and so on and so forth. I saw a presentation by you on YouTube as well in which you were not quite as alarmed or whatever it seemed. Is that right?
That's right. So basically, remember that food manufacturers and food handlers have been using food manufacturing practices and cleaning and sanitation for many years, and they're really intended to control any pathogen that can be transmitted by food. This coronavirus is not. So this particular coronavirus is not transmitted by food. It's transmitted really by person-to-person contact. So doing those extreme measures, we don't really know what is the impact there. We still recommend people to, have the regular practices that are recommended when handling food, like washing hands properly before, touching food, washing hands after that, cleaning, separating, cooking, chilling, those traditional, practices that has been around for decades.
Yeah, I read and hear in various places that the coronavirus, which you're right, it's mostly transmitted by person-to-person contact, and that's why people are talking about staying 6 feet apart from one another, so that's gives a buffer. If person A sneezes, person B less likely to have any of the droplets from the sneeze hit him or her. All of that makes sense. But what about a case in our, or is it even a possible case that, let's say I go to the grocery store and I'm going to even buy something I'm not going to eat. I'm going to get some dog food for my cocker spaniel, right? And so I pick up a couple cans of Alpo. and a grocery worker who is positive for coronavirus, unbeknownst to him or her, who stocked the shelf that morning, sneezed as he or she was doing so, got a few droplets of the sneeze on the cans of Alpo. I bring them home for my dog, and I'm opening the can and putting it in the dog food bowl, et cetera. And I get a droplet or whatever residue is there on my hand, and then of course without washing my hand, I realize now I'm violating the rules myself. But I touch my face, you know the story. I mean that's sort of the
The fear. So we hear that a lot. It's extremely remote. The probabilities are. These are very interesting questions that we don't have a complete answer. Remember, when we talk about person to person, we are not saying that surfaces are negligent, but we are also saying that surfaces are not that important for the transmission. Okay? Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, there are still practices that you can have. The practices could be hygiene practices that I call it, and then the barriers that you can use. For instance, you can use a glove to pick up that container. You can, you know, open up the food and move it to another container, dispose the glove, or wash hands afterwards. There are a lot of barriers that will prevent that passage that you are thinking hypothetically. We don't have a case. We don't know of cases like that. Even, we don't really know how long these viruses last on surfaces. There are some reports already, but those are just the first ones. We don't really have a good answer for some interesting questions, you know. We also know that the type of virus that we're talking about, which have a large envelope, they are relatively easier to clean and remove from surfaces in comparison to other viruses.
Yeah, it seems as though certainly the risk is a lot lower with this surface transmission that you're describing here, and that maybe isn't. What do you make of the fact though that there does seem to be a lot of information out there, maybe misinformation? I mean, tell us if you would characterize
right,
it that
right,
way.
Right. So there was a term that probably most of us learned in the last few weeks that is called infodemic, the spread of misinformation, right? Like an epidemic of, if you will, of misinformation. So, you know, you're mentioning something so important. It's very important for me when I try to communicate, because at the end of the day, what I do is risk communication, if you will, right? Communicate risk in a way. And I try to make sure I bring different, tools that people can use, with the caveat that we are all walking into areas that are still uncertain. We have uncertainty. We have, you know, a crisis. We don't have all the information that we would like to have. But still, we have enough of what I call, you know, surrogate information that we have for other coronaviruses, for other viruses. Coronaviruses are not really new. We have known of coronaviruses for decades. So, you know, we have some other surrogate information that we can use to kind of, you know, make sure that we reduce the opportunities for infection or contact with virus. So you're mentioning something that is so truthful. I always tell people, make sure that you really don't believe any information that you have. Don't just believe whatever you see in Facebook. Look for it, look further, look for other resources. And for me, it's always a challenge because I'm always compiling resources that we know are more, you know, fact-checked, so I can share information and not be part of this infodemic, if you will.
Yeah, I think you're touching on something here, which I have urged as a general rule just to my Facebook friends and others, where essentially, and this happens in the political realm a lot, where people see a piece of information online and it seems to support, their point of view. It either damages a politician they don't like, or it's supportive of a politician they do like, and and the immediate urge is to kind of repost it or share it or retweet it in the case of Twitter, and oftentimes that happens, and then we end up with a we end up with bad information being spread. I like your word, infodemic. I always tell folks, check it out in a few different sources, which separately from this instance to be reliable. So before you just repost it, because if you there's so many sort of literally fake news sources out there these days that if they're saying something you kind of like, it doesn't automatically make it true.
That's correct. It's unfortunately it's a little bit spread across the society and the way we deal with things sometimes, We seem to believe a lot without checking, without being a little bit more agnostic on the source of the information or trying to double check the validity of some information. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're correct.
I wonder if there's in the realm of food safety. So you're saying that basically coronaviruses have been around of different kinds have been around for a long time, and that with the food safety procedures we've had in place for decades. I just know in my own kitchen, long ago, probably earlier in our marriage, my wife kind of taught me, and she's a registered nurse, so she knows a lot about health stuff more than I do, for certainly. And she said that we should use the plastic cutting board for cutting up chicken instead of the wooden cutting board. For one small example of kind of kitchen hygiene stuff. And I'm wondering, are those practices, those basic kitchen hygiene practices that people have used, have been taught and used for a long time, providing that they are solid, based on solid information and so on. Is the message here really just continue with those?
Yeah, the message here is to go back to basics in a way, with the caveat that, remember, although we say we know those things, we know how to clean, separate, cook, and chill, we are not very good in following those practices. We have to be honest with ourselves, too.
Well.
So that's the reason why I always tell people, let's go to basics. When I, for instance, I visit, food manufacturing places, and I try to help them out with practices, right? With these practices that, again, are intended to prevent, control the transmission of foodborne diseases. So, I ask, show me how you wash hands, what are the programs that you have? And sometimes I see a lot of, we are kind of relaxed here, there. All of that has been increased. Food manufacturing, because of coronavirus, have been increasing those practices. And we should do the same. We should go back to see our kitchen and say, we were not cleaning well, we didn't care about cross-contamination. Maybe we should implement those practices. So that's why I send people back to, for instance, the food regulatory agencies here in the U.S. that have a lot of educational material, And there are many other resources very good for, how to prepare food, how to wash hands properly, how to prevent cross-contamination. So, this is a good opportunity to go to basics. And let me tell you something. From my conversation with people like this situation, like this type of crisis, they are willing to listen to other information. They are willing to really try to find facts that are more solid, if you will, in order to incorporate those at home.
My guest is Omar Oyarzabal. He is a food safety expert with the University of Vermont Extension. And as always, we welcome calls from our listeners out there. 244-1777 is the number in Waterbury. 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-8255 is the toll-free number for the Dave Graham Show and for WDEV FM and AM. And I do believe we have a listener on the line right now. Bill from Barry is calling in. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Dave, and good morning, Omar. You brought up something at the beginning of a can of dog food. I went to the grocery store yesterday, so I got a week or more before I'm going again. But anyway, You mentioned the dog food, and I bought a bunch of cans of soup. Now, I mm-hmm. can wash every one of those cans. I kind of put them under and rinse them. The paper on the outside of the can got wet. But there's other problems. You buy other things, such as cereal. Like, I bought some Cheerios. But you're not going to take that and wash down a box of Cheerios. So you can wash your hands, but the virus is on that box of Cheerios. You're in trouble. So that's
yeah, well, okay. Thanks for the call, Bill. Omar, I wanted to put that to you because, I mean, a lot of people are thinking about this now. And obviously, you know, washing a box of Cheerios is not going to leave you with a very appetizing breakfast in many cases. But you're saying that's not really necessary usually.
Right. The real point is an example of how sometimes we try to understand a risk perception, okay? So this is basically a good example of how we all perceive risk. And, you know, we are all different, you know. There are going to be practices that people are going to quit doing, and it's going to be very, very difficult to convince them to go back to it right away. In any case, if you think about a box of cereal, listen to this. You have a box, you have an outside package, and you have an internal, you know, a primary package in a bag, right? So
yep.
If you open up the box and take the plastic bag outside, we can all agree that the chances of any contaminants there are zero, correct?
Yeah.
Nobody has been opening up boxes, coughing on it, and closing them again. There's no way.
Not. Yeah.
So, you know, I ask usually, this is the reason why I try to engage with people, because I really appreciate them thinking different ways, but I also try to bring them to basic, you know, practical things that we can do. You know, it's relatively easy to wear gloves, open up the box, you know, remove the gloves, wash hands, remove the internal bag with the cereal, and now you're talking about areas that are completely clean. You can dispose the box is filled with gloves, and, you know, assuming that this contaminated, treat it as if it were contaminated, but remove it and keep the internal, you know, bag. So that would be an example. If you're talking about a can of food, I ask people, are you going to eat the can of food right away, or do you just have it for weeks there? If it's going to be for weeks, the virus is going to die. Eventually, it's going to die. So just leave it there for weeks. If you need to open it up now, be careful. Wear again barriers, wash hands, remove the internal food from the can, put it in another of your, you know, plate or one of your containers that are clean, and that's it. Voila.
That's it. Voila. Okay. Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is fairly straightforward. You just got to think about it some, and I think most people have the intelligence to figure out basic solutions to these issues. But let's go to another caller, Nancy in Morrisville. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, and thank you. I have a question about fresh produce in general, both vegetables and fruit, and especially having them raw, whether it's a salad or an apple. The surface is not something like you can peel away a banana skin and eat the banana. Also wondering about, I prefer to buy organic when I can, as opposed to traditional. And I think in this case, I suspect it could be possibly equally at risk for somebody sneezing on it, which has nothing to do with the organic process.
You raise a really interesting question. Omar, what do you think about that?
Yeah, and this is, that's a very interesting question. Again, extremely difficult to prove. We know, imagine at this time, after 2 months of this virus being in so many different countries where there has been people that turn out to be contaminated, right? I mean, they had a disease. Remember, there is a period before the symptoms appear that is pre-symptomatic that can be anywhere maybe between 1 or 3 days, and people are shedding the virus without knowing. So we have had that in households all over the globe, starting from China, Europe, in different countries here. And we don't have still information to say that, again, it's transmitted by food. Now, this particular case is a very interesting one. And that's the reason why there are a lot of people that are not eating fresh produce right away. They are trying to clean them up. They're trying to leave them at home for a couple of days. You know, they're concerned about it. And there is no solid information that we can say that say, yeah, sure, you know, trust it, because this little probability of somebody sneezing in there could exist. So basically, this is an area that we could have more, you know, information and be more decisive in telling people, you know, go for it, eat it, it's still good. Remember, we're talking about very few cases where you just eat it completely raw. In many cases, we are still cooking some of these vegetables. The cooking process with the virus, I don't believe it's a major concern, but it's very hard to communicate risk at this point, right? And tell people, just go ahead and do it. So I wish we could have more of that information, and hopefully eventually we will.
All right, let's go to another caller. I missed the name, but it's calling in from Waterbury.
Good morning, Dave.
Good morning.
Yeah, this is Roger from Waterbury.
Oh, Roger. Roger from Waterbury, of course. Yep.
The reason I'm calling is just for a quick tip. When we go grocery shopping, which is about every 2 weeks now, once we get home, we line everything up on the counter, and we take a Clorox wipe and wipe everything down, cans, boxes, bags, everything, except for the plastic bags, of course. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's necessary, but we've been doing it since this started, and it's got to be a habit now, and it's just an easy way to, you know, make yourself feel a little bit safer. You just take a Clorox wipe and wipe everything down. And I know somebody called earlier about a cereal box, and we do the same thing with a box. You don't get it soaking wet. You just kind of wipe the outside of it before you put it away. Mm-hmm. And then when you're done, you wipe down the countertops, throw the Clorox wipe away.
And let me ask Omar, is that a good practice?
You know, if that makes you feel comfortable, to it. If you ask me, can you verify or give me some, you know, approach to see if we are, you know, doing something that have an impact, I will tell you I can't. We don't have verification procedures or validated protocols for this virus. So if you ask me, can you give me scientific information, facts to prove that I'm right? I don't know. Most probably you are moving things, but I'm not sure how effective that removal is. That makes sense. So now we know with this particular virus that, you know, you can remove the virus, especially to, there are two things in here to remember. You may want to inactivate the virus on the surface or remove it. We tend to go more in food processing environments to the removal because it's relatively easier to do. Trying to destroy a virus on the spot on a surface is much more harder. So by just doing cleaning, you're going to be removing, with the caveat that the cardboard and certain material, even some plastics, they are very porous. And I'm not sure how effective it is, the removal, when you have those porous, you know, things. Sometimes you have to let the product, you know, stay there on certain contact time in order to be able to remove things. But keep in mind, for hands and for surfaces that can, with that, you know, what you can do a rubbing, like, you know, with soap and water is magic. I mean, it still does magic. It removes a lot. It's a matter of doing it properly, doing it well with the hands, lathering the hands, rubbing them well, the type of, you know, temperature of the water and the type of soap is not as important as the actual process of rubbing and doing that removal thing. If we can move that to a surface, perfect, we can do it. The moment we start having surfaces like, you know, cardboard that get wet and we just do a quick, you know, pass through, we are starting to reduce that effectiveness. Does it make sense?
Yes.
Does to me, yeah. Hey, Roger, thank you for the call. And
thank you, Roger.
We are about out of time for this segment, I do believe. Fast approaching the 9:30, and Omar Oyar Zabal, I really want to thank you for joining us this morning. A lot of good information, and I hope you helped to put some people's minds at ease to some extent as well. So thank you so much for being my guest here on the Dave Graham Show.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good day, and a good day. And thank you for all those nice questions that we received.
Alrighty, very good. We're going to be going to some bottom of the hour news with CBS and back after a couple words from our sponsors. Stay with us, folks. More to come.
Lawson's Finest, classic clothing in cutting-edge fashion. Our huge sandwiches and grab-and-go meals, toys, a wide selection of rosé, jewelry, accessories, quarter-pound cookies, and even more beer. Yankee Magazine doesn't call us the best one-stop shopping in Vermont for nothing. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back, and we are going to be talking with Ashley Eaton of the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, and about doing life science teaching over Zoom. I remember from my biology classes and so on back in high school that it was always good to be right there at those benches that seated two students, and you'd be sitting next to one another, maybe dissecting your frog or something. and you could actually be up close and personal. These days, being up close and personal is a risky thing with the coronavirus floating around. So we want to figure out a way to do education a little more distantly, and that is happening we'll hear all about it from my next guest, Ashley Eaton. Thank you so much for joining me this morning. Are you with us?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Good morning.
Oh, great. Good morning. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Great. Just sitting here in my home office, getting ready to do a little work for the day.
Yeah, all of it socially distant, which is... I don't know. I guess it's good these days that we have all these electronic tools like Zoom that we can do these things. On the other hand, I think a lot of people are going to be relieved when we can be back to. And especially, I would think this would be an issue for a science educator like yourself. So first off, tell us what you do in normal times there at the University of Vermont.
Yeah, that seems like a distant task, but. Usually I work with an education team, so Lake Champlain Sea Grant and UVM Extension, and we work on getting K-12 students and their teachers to join us at our lab at the University of Vermont Rubenstein Ecosystem Sciences Laboratory to do kind of engage in watershed science topics, whether that's in our lab, in the classroom, doing fish dissections, or out on the University of Vermont Research Vessel, the Melisira. Kind of engaging them in the research that we're doing currently, and then also kind of building some of that basic understanding. We also do a lot of work that's kind of place-based at schools, and so partnering up with them to do stream monitoring at their school or within a site that's, you know, kind of within walking distance, to do a little bit of stream ecology and monitoring and make some connections between where they are in the Lake Champlain Basin and what impact might be happening in their community to that stream or to Lake Champlain.
And the now you're doing a lot of this on Zoom, and do you find that it is effective? I mean, is it workable?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a different platform, and so I think a lot of our programming is really rooted in place and having those authentic learning experiences, and so I think. Right now, trying to shift it has been a neat way to still engage a lot of the faculty researchers and get students kind of a little bit more connected and building a relationship with the University of Vermont and UVM Extension. It is I think, more introductory. Hopefully this series will be a way for students to engage with us. It's really great because we've been able to engage with students from all over the state, all over New York State, and then we've actually had a bunch of folks join us from other states. And so it's been neat to share the work that we're doing more broadly and have there really are fewer barriers for students to participate in this type of programming, which is really great. But hopefully this will be a springboard to once we're on the other side of this COVID-19 situation, to have students joining us in the field again.
And your focus is the K-12 age group. I mean, that's a broad age group of young folks there. And I'm wondering, typically, how many, well, actually, right now, let me ask you, how many kids are participating? And are, I gather most of them are participating from home to the extent that schools are shut down and so on.
Yeah. So we've kind of been engaging in two ways. So we've got the live Zoom when it's happening, and then we also have the sessions recorded. So a lot of classroom teachers have actually been coming to the live session, getting things set up, and then using the recording with their students, kind of like all together. We've had anywhere from 50 to 100 folks on our Zoom sessions live, and then people using the kind of material later. I think a lot of the presentations are kind of balanced between being a little more technical because we're presenting on research, and then some of them are definitely geared towards younger students just to be like we just had a session on what a fish eat in the winter. And that was definitely geared towards younger students and just getting them to think about seasonality, how things change, you know, on land, but also in water throughout the basin.
That is give us a taste now. What do fish eat in the winter?
What do fish eat in the winter? Well, basically the student we had yesterday just graduated from UVM with a master's, and so he studied what fish were eating in the winter, and basically he found that yellow perch were actually eating kind of a more diverse diet in the winter, which was really interesting, but that they were still eating enough to kind of sustain, where a few other species like pumpkin seed were not able to kind of sustain what they needed throughout the winter, so they were actually relying on some reserves to help them survive.
And I still feel like there's got to be a big difference between the hands-on nature of an awful lot of life sciences learning that can occur in normal times and doing it all by Zoom. What are the anything that you feel like you're missing from you know the way you're doing it now versus the way you do this teaching normally?
Yeah, and I would say that I probably speak for all of our education team when I say that we just miss the students. We miss the energy. We miss the excitement. You know, there's definitely something different between, you know, a little like, oh, that's cool in the chat box versus, you know, seeing a student light up when they're, you know, pulling a fish out of the water for the first time, or they're seeing a lake trout for the first time, or they're, you know, looking at a plankton sample of things that they didn't even know exist in the water. Definitely a little bit of a bummer for us to miss kind of that energy and build on that. And then I think for the students, because a lot of it is based in experience, you know, they're learning about some of the content and they're seeing pictures and they're seeing videos. But I mean, there really is nothing compares to having that experience and being in that moment and just having your, you know, mind blown by something that you didn't even know existed on the bottom of a rock in a stream or in the water column in Lake Champlain or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, that is, I would gather that, you know, and again, I keep contrasting normal times with the way we are living right now, but that kind of feedback when you have the, you know, a 9-year-old with a mouth agape and kind of just looking amazed or whatever, that's got to be a really rewarding moment for a teacher.
Yeah, I mean, it's the best. And I think even it's been funny because even in our Zoom sessions, all of our presenters are talking about kind of how they got into the field. And, you know, 9 out of 10 are basically founding some experience they had in either elementary, middle, or high school where they had this phenomenal experience doing something hands-on that just changed kind of the direction that they headed. And so I think we'll be psyched to get back to, you know, working on those on the ground, in person, in the lab, on the boat kind of programs. But hopefully in the meantime, we're still keeping people's enthusiasm high about watershed science and environmental science and the Lake Champlain Basin.
I think there got to be some lessons learned here. One of which I would think is that people have speculated for a long time now about, you know, could we deliver some educational programs online, for instance? You know, can you hold a history class online? Can you hold a, you know, a foreign language class? I would think that in the sciences, certainly the life sciences, or, you know, even something like chemistry and that kind of thing, that you really can't. The only way to do it is to do it really well. I mean, obviously you're getting by now, but to do it really well, you do need to have everybody together in the same room, or, as you put it, on the same boat.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's such value to, you know, engaging in person, to be experiencing things together. You know, there's a lot of research about a learning community and all of the great things that happen from having that kind of in-person authentic experience. And I think, you know, universities have proven you can learn online, you can take classes online, but there's definitely a authentic value to being in person that is really irreplaceable, I think, for some of the field-based experiences, at least in lab-based.
It's fascinating, and as I say, it's something that I think you and many other educators right now, and students as well, are sort of forced to do this experiment of, you know, how well does this work. And I think you can see that it has certain capabilities, but also some shortcomings that obviously probably I would think that when things return to normal, you'll be wanting to for the most part, I imagine that there are some lectures or some parts of the course maybe that could be taught online, but that the by and large you are you've got to be face to face. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to add that I think one thing that we're trying really hard to do is to develop these components that, you know, will serve a purpose later. And so I think about, you know, having students join us in the lab, they always have questions about the research we're talking about. And so now, you know, they can head back to the classroom and they can watch, you know, our live discussion with this faculty member who's working on this project, or they can do this. But I think it will become supplemental to the field-based work.
That is, I think it's going to end up being sort of a mix, probably. And obviously, there's always a question about different ingredients make the dish of education. How much how much of each ingredient are you going to add to make it the best for intellectual nutrition, shall we say, if we continue with that metaphor just a little bit. I wanted to ask you also, if folks are curious about how these classes are going and so on, is there a place, you know, I could go, or one of the any listeners can go online and see what you've been up to in some of these Zoom presentations?
Yeah, definitely. And so everything is actually archived. So the sessions that we've already offered live, they're archived on our website, and that's bvm.edu/cgrants. And you can just click on our virtual learning page there. You'll see the list of all of our upcoming sessions with the topics and the researchers that are sharing. And then you'll see a section on recorded webinars where we've got all of the sessions we've hosted so far up on YouTube.
Wow, so that's something that any member of the public, I guess, can dip in and see what's going on. That's pretty cool. Let me back up for a sec, because you mentioned now a couple times the Lake Champlain Sea Grant Program. What is that exactly?
Yeah, great. Thanks for asking. So Lake Champlain Sea Grant is a program. It's actually funded through NOAA. And so there are 33 programs throughout the United States, as well as in Puerto Rico and Guam. And Sea Grant is really focused on working in specific areas. And so each program kind of has faculty and staff that work in these special sectors. And so it's environmental literacy and workforce development, which is the sector I work in. There is healthy coastal ecosystems, resilient communities and economies, and then there is one in aquaculture that we, sustainable fisheries, that we don't work on really in Lake Champlain because we don't have a commercial fishery. And so that's kind of where our work happens, and our mission at Lake Champlain Secret really is to take the research and science coming out of the university, as well as across the nation and globe, and extend it into the community so that there are both economic benefits, educational benefits. And so we really, all of our faculty and staff work to support different communities. So we have folks working in, right now actually, working a ton with marinas and trying to get marinas ready, since there's going to be so much more traffic in the early season due to COVID. We have folks working it with the real estate population, with realtors, so working on, you know, being aware of floodplains and shorelines and some of the kind of technicalities that go into purchasing land near various water facets. And then we have another colleague working in green infrastructure. So it's kind of a mosaic of different professionals working kind of in the needs-based area that that have arisen here in Vermont.
And I would gather that, you know, when I think of a federal grant program, there are going to be a lot of geographic differences and distinctions between the places where this goes. I mean, the program that is being funded with the Sea Grant in Guam, I'm sure, is different from the one on Lake Champlain, based in large part or in heavily influenced by just the local biology, the local marine life. Obviously, Guam is on the ocean. This is a lake, you know, a cold weather lake environment here. Talk to me a little bit about how the locality plays a role in this teaching, and are you able to cover all the basics that or do different areas miss some aspects because they're focused on the local ecosystem, both you know, in the environment and also in the sort of human environment?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so the National Sea Grant College Program, basically, which is what Sea Grant is kind of derived from, is basically created to create and maintain healthy coastal environments and economies. And so that's kind of a broad statement. And so it does look really different depending on which Sea Grant program you're talking about. And so I think one way that they kind of maintain the integrity of that program is through those focus areas. Every program is working on kind of what is alive and relevant for their community. And so at heart of this, it really is solving the community needs. And so it looks, you know, like our program looks different than Guam, one, because we're not a marine ecosystem, but also because our communities are struggling with really different things. And so something that I think is really valuable about the Sea Grant program is that it's adaptive to the community. It responds to what's happening. So, you know, like all of our staff, we're responding right now to COVID-19 and trying to work with our sectors to kind of get them where they need to be and providing resources, thinking about, you know, after Hurricane Irene, we responded with kind of assisting Vermont DEC with some of the floodplain management that came out of that and the River Corridor project. And so I think, you know, we do work more closely with our colleagues out in the Great Lakes because we're all struggling with the same kind of larger freshwater issues. But then, you know, we do have some autonomy in the Lake Champlain Sea Grant program to, you know, meet with folks from the community, to work with all of our community partners. And we have a program advisory board that actually helps us kind of set four-year goals based on what's relevant in the community at that time. And so I think something that's really wonderful is that, you know, we are kind of more, we have a more broad scope. And so we're able to just kind of adjust to community needs kind of every omnibus, every four-year grant cycle.
A listener is emailed me and asked me another question that I would like to relay to you after fashion and on this question of online learning and so on, and says this is early stage transformation of possibly changing the way we educate, hybrid to start. What financial benefits, property tax and environmental benefits could arrive if we hybrid? So I think where that question really is going is, let's say you could have a class that met in person 5 days a week and is able to transition to meeting 3 days a week and two online. So now there's 40% less driving involved because people are able to do it from home. And so you have an environmental benefit there, perhaps. And maybe you're able to encompass, you know, more students who are doing this at home than you would in a normal. So you might have even some labor savings in terms of how much faculty and staff you need and so on in the aggregate. I mean, I'm sure this would be in little bits and pieces all across the kind of the educational economy. Have you given any thought to that? And are those two reasons to really sort of maybe push this online learning idea?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think, you know, you nailed it. Obviously, there's environmental benefits of not having people travel so far, not having them travel so often. There are educational benefits to geographic reach, like you mentioned. So, you know, reaching more broadly. And I think, you know, I think paired with that, one of the challenges that our program has is we either want people to come to us at the lab or we want to go to them. And so in that, you know, there is a geographic barrier. We can only travel so far in a day. And even though Vermont is a pretty small state, you know, it's really difficult to get to the South Lake and all the way back up in one day if you're doing a full day program. And so I think that is a huge benefit for students that maybe don't have busing at their school district, if they can't get to us, if it's just far enough away that we can't really get to them either. I think that's one of the kind of the huge perks, at least as an educator, that I see. I think additionally, some of this stuff is easy to archive and teachers can use it whenever. And I think there's a kind of a long lasting reach there in the sense that, you know, we don't have to be one-on-one all the time to relay this information. Now we have some of these kind of nuggets and webinars and pieces where we can point teachers to share the same information in ways that they can probably facilitate it and feel pretty comfortable about that. I think what's challenging for the work that we do, you know, we're really trying to get students to change their perception of something. So rather than just teaching them content about, you know, lake science or stream ecology, we're also trying to get them to become stewards. And I think, you know, doing that and moving from just kind of content-based learning to, you know, actual behavior change and learning about your place and connecting with it, you have to have those kind of touchstones. And so it'll be interesting to see in the future how this all blends together and what things look like for us and how we're able to adapt kind of in both of those realms, I think.
And Ashley, I wondered if you could tell us just your thoughts about these kids who are in the program right now and are a lot of, my sense is a lot of school kids, that K-12 audience that you talk to on a regular basis are feeling a little bit at sea right now because they are in a very unusual circumstance where they're not going to school on a daily basis. They're trying to do some classes online with their teachers and so forth. And any sort of message you'd like to share with them just in terms of how to keep them focused and staying with it?
that's a great question. I think for all the students that are out there and the teachers that are out there listening to this and then all the parents that are working on, you know, trying to homeschool right now during this time, I think the resources can definitely be overwhelming. And I think just every day set a little goal, and if that goal is attending, you know, a Zoom Scientist for 1 hour and that's going to be your learning for the day, I think that's, at this time, I think that's a win. I think if you can find little components to be engaged, I think that's a win for everyone out there.
Yeah, that is that could be a definite win. So Ashley Eaton of the Watershed and Lake Champlain, you are the Watershed Lake Champlain Education Coordinator with the Lake Champlain Sea Grant. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks so much.
All righty. We're going to go to our top of the hour break for some CBS news and a couple words from our sponsors. And when we return, I believe we'll be having an individual conversation with one of our CBS correspondents. We'll be back.
There's comfort in the familiar, but when life presents us with something exciting, we just have to embrace it. With so many of our neighbors producing such wonderful products, we just have to show and tell the world. Come in and see for yourself the old standbys alongside the new. Change is good. The one thing that never changes is our commitment to making your visit a great experience. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into our second hour on this Thursday morning, April the 16th, 2020. And wanted to check in with Bill Rakoff of CBS News. CBS is very kindly offers the application to our one of their correspondents to talk with us individually on an individual basis here at WDEV, and we really appreciate that. Good morning, Bill Rakoff. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me, Dave.
And tell me a little bit about the headlines of this coronavirus thing. The president says we may have passed the peak, and are we on a downward slope now?
Well, I mean, if you look at the aggregate, you can make the argument for that if you look at the United States as a whole. But the problem is you have to look at this as a segmented thing. And in some cases, yes, New York is at the peak, or even Governor Cuomo seems to think maybe they are there and they may be starting down the backside of it. But you've got other areas in the country that are still ramping up for this. And you think about places on the West Coast, down in California. There are other cities that are saying that they're just, you know, maybe starting their upslope. So, you know, while there's optimism in parts of the country, you know, the temptation is to kind of loosen the reins a little bit. And what health officials are saying is, no, we really can't do that. But, you know, you could look at a regional approach to it, because while some are, you know, coming out and then see the light at the end of the tunnel, as the president's put it, there are others that are just getting into that tunnel.
Yeah, that's obviously one concern, is this is not hitting sort of at the same pace everywhere in the country. So it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all situation. What kind of reaction is this getting from, is the president's idea of you know, starting to loosen up in some places, what kind of reaction is that getting from the public health community out there?
It's getting a real tepid response, even from his own folks who are saying, look, you know, what the president is doing is he's saying aspirational things. That's something that Dr. Fauci has used several times when responding to the president, who's saying, well, I think we could reopen. He's aspiring to do that, is what the health experts say. Others are just simply saying it's irresponsible. He shouldn't be saying these types of things when his own health experts say, look, it's not the time to let off the gas just yet. Now, even though we're starting to see signs that people are making plans to come out of recovery, we see Starbucks saying they may open some cafes in some areas that are on the downward slope side of this. And we just got a statement from the PGA Tour saying that they're going to eye a return to the schedule on June 8th with the Fort Worth Invitational, the Charles Schwab Challenge, albeit they'll do it without spectators. So, you know, it's an interesting time. And I think you're at this point, Dave, I think with a lot of people, that it's kind of like, yeah, we've all got sort of coronavirus cabin fever at this point, and we're just looking for any sign that we can bust out of it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, are you hearing any of the major league sports, are they starting to stir in their slumber, or are they staying down for a while longer?
Well, this thing from the PGA today is really the first thing that we've seen from anybody. In the world of professional sports, at least in this country, saying, hey, look, you know, we're even just beginning to take a look at this. Now, baseball has been trying to go through some type of evaluation of how to do it. They've been tossing around ideas of maybe playing the season, or at least the first part of the season, in Arizona at one stadium without spectators, and just having the teams come in almost like a big time little league tournament, if you will. Beyond that, no one's really talking. I think everybody's holding back and, you know, just trying to take the responsible route. But, you know, as time goes on, you're going to see not only the leagues, but the fans chomping at the bit to try to see if we can't at least, you know, aspire to some level of normalcy.
I'll tell you, there's a lot of fans out there where I almost as a joke a week or two ago, put up a post on Facebook where I said, I miss sport, fill in the blank, I miss sports so much I would watch dot, dot, dot. And I don't think I've ever gotten as much reaction to a Facebook post.
Yeah, well, you know, I tell you what's really been fun about this is you know, the sports channels have been putting up, you know, the old games and things like that. And I'm a Pittsburgh kid, so I got to see Game 7 of the 1979 World Series and my hero Willie Stargell hit the game-winning home run, you know, and be able to do it with my kid. Hey, look, man, it's better than nothing. And you can show the kids at least, you know, a little bit of what it was like back in the day. But, you know, I digress. It's what we have to do to pass the time. But it is fun to see these things.
Yeah, I'm a Celtics fan, so I've been watching some Larry Bird lately. Same idea. I do wonder, actually, you know, whether the NBA in particular, which was approaching the end of its regular season and getting toward the playoffs on the normal calendar, whether they're going to be able to resurrect this 2020 thing at all. I don't know whether what's happening on that front. I haven't checked in the last couple of days, so we'll have to follow the news, I guess, on all of that. Now, in terms of the businesses out there, are we likely to see any sort of relief from really down statistics and huge unemployment rate and et cetera, et cetera? When do we start to see a ripple that says the economy is waking up? Even if, I mean, let's say we start to loosen these restrictions in early May, is it going to be a couple of months, or would it happen right away, or what do we think?
Well, you know, in talking to the experts, and I'm certainly not one of them, our colleague, business analyst Jill Schlesinger here at CBS is saying, look, this could be a slow walk out of recovery, and this could be something that it does have some lingering issues for a while. So even if we come out of it from the illness side and people start to spend money and get back out there and companies are able to start ramping up, there's obviously a lag time before, you know, you see recovery. And the biggest part of that is going to be how willing will the companies be to bring back the workers that they've laid off. And I think that's going to be a huge problem. And then on the flip side of that, Congress is going to have to react to that right now. But they're stuck in a little bit of partisan squabbling last night or this week while they're away. They're just not getting – they need an interim coronavirus relief bill passed at the very least, but it doesn't seem like they're getting any traction toward that this week. So, I mean, on one hand, the companies have to respond, but on the other hand, Congress has to respond to the need as well. And that all those things combined may mean for a little bit of a slower climb out of the hole than I think that most of us would like.
Yeah. Well, Bill Rakoff of CBS News, I thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us this morning. It's always good talking with you.
Same with you guys. Be healthy.
Alrighty. Have a good day. Stay healthy yourself. Going to be talking in a little bit with Bill McKibben, longtime Vermont-based environmentalist, environmental activist on climate issues in particular. And Bill McKibben is a good friend of WDEV. Has actually wrote a book about it was a fictional account of, but we're told. Based not even a little bit, but a lot on the life and times of WDEV. So we're going to be talking to him in just a few minutes. The Dave Graham Show wants to open the phone lines now and take a few calls from listeners. If you have any questions or comments that you'd like to bring to our attention, you're more than welcome to call us at 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. And we do love to hear listeners out there. I was just noticing, noticed earlier today, but was going back and reviewing for myself the lead item in vtdigger.org this morning, the terrific online news source for Vermont news. vtdigger.org is all about the concerns about a lot of people are having with our state unemployment system. We actually had Labor Commissioner Michael Harrington on our program last week, and trying to get him back. We'd love to have him do a follow-up with Commissioner Harrington. I'm going to be reaching out to them again today to see about lining something up for maybe Monday or Tuesday on the Dave Graham Show, because there are a lot of questions continuing with the unemployment system in Vermont. Of course, no one expected this coronavirus crisis. No one expected to have the incredible wave of calls and filings of unemployment claims by Vermonters that we've seen now in the last several weeks. Fair to say the system is overwhelmed and has been essentially swamped and unable to respond as well as Commissioner Harrington and Governor Phil Scott would like it to. And in fact, the lead item in Digger this morning talks all about this. The governor was making comments about it at one of his regular news conferences yesterday. And he said, it's not enough for me to say, have some patience, because this isn't about patience. I accept responsibility for this, the governor said. This is an area that we didn't foresee, and certainly no excuses, but we need to do better. And so there's a tone to that, which, you know, I have to commend this governor for being straightforward on something like that. It's not a pretty picture. And he acknowledges it's not a pretty picture. We need to do better. It's as simple as that. I'm sure they're working on it pretty diligently. That is a tone that is considerably different from a certain other politician we all know down in Washington who talks all about how we're doing a great job. We've done a great job, and et cetera, et cetera. Everything is beautiful. I'm sort of curious to hear from listeners about do you think that this is a better way to go, or do you think that that the real trying to put a rosy lens on everything is actually a superior way for a politician to approach these very, very tough issues that I'm trying to give everybody, including the president, including the governor, and all of the others, federal and state officials involved in responding to this coronavirus crisis, some leeway, because this is something that, you know, if I had any of those jobs, I'm not sure what I would have done. I mean, these are crazy times, you know, there's been a lot of debate about how unforeseen. I mean, obviously there have been warnings about possible pandemics for years. We should have been, I think everybody understands now, we should have been doing a better job at both the state and federal level, really gearing up and planning for this kind of eventuality. But there is quite a difference between suddenly finding yourself in this crisis and trying to respond in a real-time, real way just immediately, and then reflecting on, oh gee, I wish I had planned on doing something better a year ago. I mean, both things can be kind of true simultaneously. So these are all important, I think, important considerations for people to weigh when they try to decide, are politicians handling this as well as they could, or are there big flaws in the response and so on. The Digger story. Let's see. I believe we have a listener on the line. Let's go to Bob and Charlotte. Good morning, Bob.
Morning, Dave. I think regardless of what they say, either whether Trump says it's all great and wonderful or Governor Scott says that they need to do better, the fact of the matter is some people aren't getting anything right now. So, you know, to just keep talking about it doesn't solve the problem. And Governor Scott kind of hinted around that he was going to try to do something for people that have applied for self-employment. But people that are self-employed haven't seen anything yet. And this is, we're going on 6 weeks now.
Bob, it sounds like you're getting impatient. Are you in that situation yourself where you're trying to apply for unemployment, or
I'm not thought? Really impatient. I'm just annoyed that there's a whole lot of talking going on, and then to find out, you know, today that the payment protection plan has run out of money, the EIDL, who knows where that is? You can't get an honest answer from anybody in the government right now because they all have a different. You know, each person you contact has a different answer for you. And the state, this is ridiculous. We're one of the few states that is actually, we're like the slowest state in the country right now when it comes to processing self-employment claims through the unemployment office. And, you know, they keep saying, oh, it's almost here. We've almost got the program going. It's almost ready. And then the next day, it's almost ready. It's almost ready. You know, this is all we hear. We don't see anything. So it doesn't matter who says what. The fact of the matter is nobody's getting anywhere. It's like we're stuck in the mud.
Yeah, I hear your frustration, Bob, and I don't really blame you at all for feeling that way. I guess there's I mean, I think back a couple of years to the fiasco involved in the launch of the Vermont Health Connect system, the health, state health insurance program set up under the Affordable Care Act, and there was months and months to sort of plan that and get that up and running, and it had tons of problems. Right. You know, here we've had a few weeks to try to take a state agency that probably felt a kind of a sleepy environment for a long time, given the Vermont's low unemployment rate. You know, it's like, when's our phone going to ring? And then all of a sudden, right, it's ringing off the hook, and there's no stop to it. There's a deluge. So, I mean, in some respects, I have a certain degree of sympathy there, but I understand that if you're out of work and you need money to buy groceries, and you expect the system to step in when you need it, and it's not, you know, you're not getting your direct deposit or your check or whatever, that's got to hurt. I mean, for sure. I mean, I wish I had a better answer for you than to tell you I'm sympathetic, but I'm hoping that certainly I get a sense that Governor Scott, you know, from his remarks yesterday, he's focused, he's taking it seriously now. I assume that, you know, in sort of the private meetings he's having with his other state officials, he's starting to crack the whip and say, we really got to get this going here, folks, because it's a crisis out there. So, yeah. Bob, thank you for the call. Go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to say, I wouldn't want his job at all. And I'm not saying that I could do any better. You know, there is a lot of bureaucracy in this. And it's just, you know, he is doing a good job. The bottom line is we're still not seeing any results. But like I said, you know, there's obviously nothing he can do about it by just, with a swipe of a pen, I don't think. So
just keep
waiting.
All right. Well, Bob, thank you for the call. I really appreciate it.
Yep.
And don't be shy. Let us know how you're doing out there as the weeks go on. We're going to bring in a guest that I originally had scheduled for after the bottom of the hour break, but we're so excited to have him on. We're getting him on a little early, and that is Bill McKibben. He, of course, is over in the Middlebury area. He's been a visiting scholar at Middlebury College. He is a writer and environmentalist, an environmental activist, has been trying to talk to society at large about the impending crisis of climate change for a good more than 30 years now. And had a really interesting piece in the New Yorker I think last week about the how to sort of look at a crisis and its unfolding and the tendency, I think, many times to bury one's head in the sand when something is coming. And Bill McKibben, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Dave, what a pleasure. What a pleasure always to get to hear the show, too. You've been doing a great job of keeping people together and going this last month, and I think everybody's pretty grateful.
Well, I appreciate the words, Bill. Let me ask you, I was fascinated by this piece in the New Yorker. I just had a conversation a couple of days ago with someone where we were kind of looking at the almost like a political science exercise in handling crises and this tendency. You see it with climate change. You've seen it certainly, you know, in slow-mo compared to this coronavirus crisis. But even in the coronavirus crisis, you know, it takes a month or 6 weeks for it to sink in with top leadership. I don't know if you saw
depends
a terrific.
Depends on your
go
top
ahead.
Leadership.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw a terrific miniseries on HBO last fall about the Chernobyl nuclear accident.
Yeah.
But, you know, those initial meetings of the Soviet Politburo talking about what's going on over there in at this nuclear plant. Oh, nothing much. It's no big problem.
Yeah, no,
you know, same kind of thing.
Reminiscent. The cases are going to zero next week. It all gets better when the weather gets warm. Yeah, no.
Yeah. Well, we're having a chilly April, which actually leads me to one question that a listener actually hit me up with this morning. He said, should we, people are talking about the sort of a little breather we're giving the climate with a lot less pollution being produced since our economy's been shut down and not many people are commuting, et cetera. Any tie there or...
So
I was saying I have my doubts that it's
right.
that immediate.
So there's no, I mean, A, climate change didn't cause coronavirus. There are things in our relationship with nature, especially the way that we're now cutting down rainforests, that are bringing people and wild animals closer together, that leads to, helps lead to these kind of things. But climate change didn't cause this, nor will this cure climate change. You know, if we go right back to doing everything we were doing before, which is what we did after the financial crisis in 2008, then we'll be back where we were before. But the question you raise is a really interesting one. I mean, there's no silver linings to a traumatic and painful episode that's going to kill a lot of people and alter everyone's lives. But if you're going to go through that pain, you might as well learn some things. And I think that there are a bunch of lessons that we can, you know, unpack one after another about what this tells us about the world we live in and how we might want to live in it a little bit differently.
Well, it sounds like we've got some lessons to unpack. As it happens, we need to go to a bottom hour break for some CBS
news.
And a couple of words from our sponsors. Let's get into some of those individual lessons, and as you put it, unpack them after the break. We'll do that. Bill McKibben is my guest, and he is going to be staying with us right up to the top of the hour here, folks. So you stay with us, too. We'll be back shortly.
Lawson's Finest, classic clothing in cutting-edge fashion. Our huge sandwiches and grab-and-go meals, toys, a wide selection of rosé, jewelry, accessories, quarter-pound cookies, and even more beer. Yankee Magazine doesn't call us the best one-stop shopping in Vermont for nothing. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
My guest is Bill McKibben, and we're talking about some of the lessons we might learn from the coronavirus crisis and maybe apply some of them to another crisis that Mr. McKibben has been writing about and talking about and getting active about for decades now, and that, of course, is the climate crisis. And Bill McKibben, I wanted to talk with you, get you to reflect on this business of the commonality between crises and how there does seem a tendency among an awful lot of people to first want to deny, duck, and just sort of avoid thinking about coming problems.
Well, I mean, think about the most. Let's think about this in the deepest way first. I mean, I think the thing that the coronavirus reminds us is that physical reality is real, which is sounds like an absurdly obvious thing to say, but I think an awful lot of the time, an awful lot of people forget it. Maybe a little less so out here in the country where we live, but, you know, our lives are spent looking at screens. You know, we live in insulated homes, we drive to air-conditioned malls, on and on and on. And so it's taken, I mean, I've spent the last 30 years trying to convince people that physics and chemistry are real. That's really what climate change is, that you can't spin them, you can't force them to compromise. They're not going to negotiate with you. They don't care about where in the election cycle you are. Exactly the same thing is true of biology. That's what coronavirus is teaching us. It doesn't matter that the president doesn't like it. It doesn't matter that he wants to open things back up. It doesn't, I mean, the coronavirus is telling us stand 6 feet apart. It's setting the rules. Biology sets the limits here. And the second goes to just what you were saying, the sort of that follows from that is the most important of those limits and have to do with time. And we're seeing precisely how delay can be fatal here. So, I mean, the classic example is what we're talking about with flattening the curve. Both the U.S. and South Korea had their first case on the same day in January. South Korea leaders took it seriously. They began to do somewhat disruptive things. No large gatherings, started testing people left and right, so on and so forth. They haven't solved the problem by any means there, but they're, you know, they're looking at it, if not in the rear view mirror, then at least in the side view mirror at this point. It's not crashing through the front windshield. We didn't do that. You know, we decided to entertain a series of, you know, were obviously fantasies that somehow the warm weather would make it go away, that there would be a miracle, that the cases were going to go to zero, that you could take some drug that someone told someone about and that would cure you, on and on and on. And so what we get because we delay is, A, we have to be way more disruptive when we finally do get around to doing things, and B, even when we do those things, we still end up with a lot of people dead. The carbon curve is pretty much precisely the same. It just plays out over a few decades instead of a few months. You know, if people had paid attention 30 years ago when scientists started talking about climate change, then we could have done some pretty modest things 30 years ago. A slight price on carbon, slight carbon tax would have been enough to steer economies in new directions gently over the course of decades. We wouldn't have solved the problem by this point, but we'd be well on the way. But instead, we did just the opposite. We put the accelerator down. We went straight ahead. We've burned more carbon since the scientists issued the first warnings and then around 1990 than in all of human history before. So now, since we didn't flatten the curve, we have to take extraordinarily disruptive and expensive action to deal with climate change. And even so, we're going to end up with, well, we're already ending up with all kinds of disruptions. It's hard for us to remember now, but it wasn't, you know, 10 weeks ago when pretty much the entire continent of Australia was on fire in the, in some ways, the most dramatic firestorm the world's almost ever seen.
Yeah, and well, I mean, a couple of things entered my mind as you were talking here, and one is that in terms of differences between the coronavirus response and the climate change response, coronavirus has not had an extensive cadre of lobbyists,
right,
and think tanks and op-ed
right.
writers.
That's the
out there.
You hit
poo-pooing it.
You hit precisely the key thing, and I've said this to people, and most of them don't think of it as quickly as you did. The only real difference is there's not a trillion-dollar industry that's predicated on making you catch coronavirus. And there is a trillion-dollar industry that's predicated on continuing to burn the things that cause climate change. That's why, you know, we'll eventually take action on this. But it is a remarkable reminder of how dumb it is to, even in economic terms, to only listen in this case to the fossil fuel industry. We're going to do so much economic damage with climate change that we're getting a taste of now. I mean, these kind of disruptive events to economies are what you desperately want to avoid, but they're what we're locking in year after year, decade after decade, if we don't take really seriously the need to move off coal and gas and oil.
You know, I think another difference here is that people started reading some of the articles that were written a month or so ago in places like New York Magazine and a lot of popular media,
yeah,
actually, kind of like how you die if you're
yep,
dying of coronavirus. And boy, what a hideous thing. I mean, it just,
absolutely,
you know, and I think the people, nobody has really put their minds around yet kind of, you know, how does climate change affect me?
Well, so it depends where you are. Like, let me tell you, people in Australia are now really clear because thousands upon thousands of them had to wade into the ocean in order to avoid being burned to death, you know. That was the only way out on beach town after beach town down the Australian coast. People in California have a pretty good idea of what climate change means in terms of fire season now and so on. And, you know, the rest of us will learn in piece by piece if that's how we're going to insist on learning this, through direct exposure, because it's coming for everyone. We got, you know, the first taste in Vermont with Irene. That's precisely the kind of event that scientists tell us will become far more likely and far more intense. But it's worth remembering, too, however, that even just in thinking about terms of people's health, the continuing to burn fossil fuels takes an extraordinary toll. You've seen the pictures from Delhi, the most polluted city in the world, which all of a sudden has clean air, which is nice. But those before pictures, and I'm afraid the soon-to-be after pictures, of the incredibly dirty air, I mean, if you're worried about lung damage from coronavirus, and you sure should be, of the 5 million children who live in New Delhi, 2.5 million have irreversible lung damage just from breathing the dirty air. So, you know, there are a whole lot of things we should be working on. It is absolutely true that because coronavirus is so happens so swiftly and is so dramatic that it grabbed people's attention, and it has no choice. We have no choice but to fight it. And it's very good to see that we can fight it. I think that's another lesson that's coming out of here. When you have strong leadership and when you have pretty high levels of social trust and social solidarity, then you can get a lot done fast. I saw somebody today saying that Vermont may have done a better job of flattening the coronavirus curve than almost any place in the country. And if that's true, it doesn't surprise me. It's because whenever they do measures of social trust, you know, how well, you know, how many people volunteer in the community, you know, how many, what kind of network of friends do you have, local, you know, how local, how many local businesses are there, that kind of thing. Vermont is always at the very top of the list among American states. And that's just what you need. You know, we do not have, we've got a governor who acted wisely and straightforwardly and has been open and transparent. And, I mean, that means that there aren't, did you see the pictures yesterday of the crowd of people in Michigan who decided to show up at the governor's office and demand that the place be reopened and, you know, were like crowded together? And, I mean, it was just, it was ridiculous.
I also saw a video interview of a hospital worker in Lansing who said that he couldn't get to work at his hospital because of the tied up traffic. And he just lit into these people, calling them idiots over and over again, because he's trying to go to work so he can help patients who have the coronavirus.
And now he's going to have to help them because they're all breathing in each other's faces for, you know, 3 hours.
I shouldn't laugh. It's a tragedy in the making, and it's just frankly kind of a horror show that
it
doesn't need
really,
to happen at all.
We do really see, I got to say, what happens when you don't have good leadership. I was reading last night, I read the new, very, very good new biography of Winston Churchill's first year in office by that guy, Eric Larson, who's written several bestsellers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, Churchill had all kinds of vices, you know, and there were things that were wrong. But for that year, in kind of the last crisis that the Western world has faced on this scale, you know, a city that had to shut down because of the Blitz and so on and so forth, the difference that good, smart, curious, hardworking, empathetic, above all, leadership meant was, you know, that was the difference between survival and not for, for England and in certain ways for the Western world. And, you know, I mean, say what you will about the politics of the president, just the fact that he's a, you know, incompetent buffoon is depressing on a kind of hour-by-hour basis.
Let's let a couple of listeners in here. I believe we have Michael on the line from Barrytown. Good morning, Michael.
Oh, good morning, Dave. I have enormous respect for your work, Bill. I have for many years, and I have a two-part question for you. It seems that over the years, the divisions between who believes the reality of climate change, who doesn't, and now it's the same thing with COVID-19. And these default lines seem to have come along the lines of political ideology, with the right tending to deny it and the left taking it very seriously or much more seriously. So the first question is, do you have any explanation for how it ever got into a partisan issue as opposed to scientific? And the second part of my question is, how do we ever bridge this gap so that we can start coming together and dealing with it?
So, Michael, those are both excellent questions. The first one, how we ended up here, Much of my last book was kind of devoted to talking about that in terms of climate, but in much larger sense. So first of all, there's the thing that Dave brought up. I mean, look, the richest industry in the world 15, 20 years ago was the fossil fuel industry, and it used some of that money to, in effect, purchase the National Republican Party, and it, you know, therefore, this has been a partisan issue all along. But it goes deeper than that. You know, the governing philosophy in a lot of ways of America for the last 40 or 45 years was set by Ronald Reagan, and this deep hostility to government and the idea that markets would solve all problems. You know, Reagan famously said the nine scariest words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help you." But it turns out those aren't the scariest. I mean, the scariest words in the English language are, "We've run out of ventilators," or "The hillside behind your house is now caught on fire." Those are really scary, and those are the reason that we need government, which after all is just all of us working together to try and take care of problems that markets don't solve. Markets do some things very well, but relying on them to solve climate change has meant that we've lost half the summer sea ice in the Arctic. I mean, the invisible hand of the economy is great in certain ways, but right now we've got to wash our hands, you know. They've got to be really visible. The third answer to that question, the kind of pragmatic one, how did we go so wrong? I mean, if you had to pick, I think, the most dangerous guy on the planet, it would probably be Rupert Murdoch. And if you look around the world to sort of see where his media empire is the strongest, it's where you find this kind of crazy, endless partisan division. So Australia, where he started, or Britain, where he went next and set up the tabloid newspapers that, you know, have done much to destabilize their political system, or, of course, here, where Fox News has just become, I mean, the coronavirus was at almost in parody. I mean, they spent a month telling everybody that it was not a problem at all, and then the minute that Donald Trump decided it was a problem, then, you know, they switched to Donald Trump is the fearless, resolute leader who will get us through the coronavirus. I mean, you know, it's to call it journalism is, it doesn't resemble the kind of journalism that Dave spent his life doing, for instance. So those are the problems. The ways around them are, of course, hard, but I think we see the outlines of some of them. I mean, one is that over time, Mother Nature, and in the case of coronavirus, short time, climate a little longer, Mother Nature is a great educator. You know, if you look out the window and there's a big firestorm and it's happening every summer where you live and so on, at a certain point, who are you going to believe? You know, Fox News or your own lying eyes? We also need to do the work of building movements to make sure that people understand. And that's one of the ways that we educate people. And we've built a big one around climate change over the last 10 years. And together, those are the reasons that we now have 70, 75% of Americans who are signed on to the idea that climate change is a terrific problem that we have to do something about. I think the third way that we knit this stuff together is with a series of solutions that appeal to everyone. So one of the good things about climate change is that for the last 10 years, the engineers have done a bang-up job, and the price of a solar panel or a wind turbine's dropped 90%. It's now the cheapest way to generate power. The engineers have done a terrific job and built electric cars that go fast and far. I don't know whether you heard, there was one of the funnier press conferences of the last couple of years when Governor Scott was talking about climate change, and you know, I'm not convinced it's the thing that most animates him, and he's been, his policies on it haven't been all that good and whatever, but when he got around to electric cars, man, he completely understood what was going on. I mean, he's a motorhead and he knows that, you know, you can go 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds or something in a Tesla. And so, you know, that's a perfect example of the place that we're going. By the way, I will add at the moment that if you don't like going out right now and feel a little uneasy about contact with the larger world, there's something very nice about the fact that my gas station is the plug socket on the wall of my garage, I got to say.
You know, I wanted to ask you actually about transportation because, you know, just on a very personal level, my carbon footprint up until the middle of March, I think it was, mainly consisted of my drive back and forth to Waterbury every day. I live in Montpelier, and I would drive over to WDEV in the morning, and I actually looked into you know, the commuter bus which runs in the morning from Montpelier up through Waterbury to Burlington, but there wasn't one back at midday where I needed to get back to Montpelier for my other part-time job in the afternoon. And
yes, transportation in a rural state's always going to be really hard. So we should be to places where we can do buses, we should be doing them. And there's some great examples. Addison County Transit's really pretty good, I got to say. I'm grateful for it. Runs right up 125 to the top of the gap past the Snowball, you know, in Ripton and Hancock. So that's pretty good. But look, people are going to be driving cars here for quite a while. So that's why it's really important to start building out the electric charging infrastructure everywhere, because these cars are coming and they're great and they're no longer super expensive. I looked up the price the other day for an average new car in the U.S., and it's on average about $36,000. And
wow.
I paid less than that for new electric Kia, Kia Niro EV earlier this year. And it's a great car. Its performance is terrific. It's quiet. It goes 300 and some miles or almost before you need to charge it again. And it has essentially no moving parts. There's not going to be much that breaks down on it. So we really have reached the point where these things are entirely feasible. And with a little bit of smart public policy in terms of subsidies, in terms of setting up the charging infrastructure and stuff, we can roll them out fast. And we should. You know, we've got it.
You know, I got to say, I got to ask you also just about an awful lot of people who are not driving at all by virtue of the fact that they're working from home right now. And I'm wondering, is that something that ought to be pushed as we emerge from this as a way to address our carbon footprints? Because
Well, we've clearly learned some things. Like, people have been talking about telecommuting for years, and, you know, but it turns out that you can do it. I mean, we're probably, companies are probably learning a lot. And, you know, I don't think it's going to replace offices entirely. There are good things about people coming together in places to work and things, but clearly we can do less of it. And I don't think anyone, I mean, I don't think there's anyone in America, I mean, Vermonters are usually pretty lucky here, but, you know, no one in America would really complain about giving up, you know, an hour's commute each way. Or doing it 3 days a week instead of five or whatever. And so, yeah, I mean, lifestyle changes are possible and big infrastructure changes are possible, as we find out when we're in a crisis. I mean, look, the federal government has, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to bail out industries. While we're bailing them out, we should be making sure that those industries are then going to be doing something back for us and not contributing to the next crisis. So if you want to bail out an oil company, you need to make sure that they have, you know, that they're compliant with the Paris Climate Accords going forward in their business plan. This is just what happened with the auto industry in 2008. When Detroit got bailed out, the thing that society asked of them through Barack Obama was dramatic increases in automobile mileage requirements going forward. That's how we got this big increase in CAFE standards that was driving change in the auto industry until last week when the Trump administration got rid of it.
The a lot of steps back in recently. In fact, I just saw a headline crossed my screen here a little bit ago, in which I think it was the New York Times reporting a relaxation of rules governing mercury pollution.
I mean, one after another. Here's the single most galling one. Some listeners will remember that, you know, we've been working, lots of us, all over the country on this Keystone Pipeline for 10 years. blocking this big tar sands pipeline down out of Canada. Well, it was not going to get built because it's not economic. It just makes no sense. But as soon as the coronavirus came, under the cover of it, with everyone looking the other way, the Alberta government put up $4 or $5 billion of their taxpayer money, and Chase Bank and other banks immediately chipped in another couple of billion, and they decided they were going to start construction, even though this meant bringing in construction workers from around the country to rural parts of America with medical systems even more strained than, say, Vermont's, and to the edge of Indian reservations. You know the history of Native Americans in this continent. 90% of them died in one pandemic or another over the last 500 years. One leader in South Dakota said, "This feels a lot like smallpox blankets to us." They did this even though, to build a new oil pipeline, even though at the same time the federal government is bailing out the oil industry by paying them not to pump oil and doing everything they can to keep Russia and Saudi Arabia and whatever from pumping more. We've got more oil than we could ever know what to do with, and yet they declared building a new oil pipeline an essential service. That should pretty much tell you what you need to know about how power works at the moment in our country.
Yeah, the here's one last thing that I want to run by you, Bill. A headline here says, "Small increases in air pollution make coronavirus much more deadly." So, I mean, let's tie these things together in a very practical way.
If you care about your lungs, then we've got a lot of work to do protecting lungs and protecting the lungs of the earth and protecting the future. And we can do it. We're clearly capable of doing, making big changes when we need to, and we need to on lots of counts. So no one's going to look back on this happily, what we're going through, but maybe we'll be able to look back on it proudly if we don't just revert straight back to normal, if we take the time and the opportunity to try and make changes that really most people know we need to make.
Bill McKibben, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's great talking with you, and I really appreciate you giving us this much time.
A great pleasure as always, Dave. Take care, man.
Alrighty, you too. Let's go to top of the hour here, the end of the Dave Graham Show for this Thursday morning, April the 16th. Thanks so much for joining us, folks. And we'll do it again tomorrow morning. Meanwhile, stay tuned now for Bill Zare, Common Sense Radio. And have a great afternoon, everybody. Stay healthy.